Today on Mosaic, we have the chance to talk with conductor James Blatchley. He is the music director of the Johnstown Symphony Orchestra, also music director of the Experiential Orchestra, and also serves as music director of the Geneva Light Opera. And there's a very interesting project that brings a work back to light many, many years after it was completed. We'll be talking about that as well. James, Maestro, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
My real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We often, when we are talking with artists, composers, conductors, it's very typical. I'm sure you've answered questions like this many, many times over, but audiences are always curious to know if you grew up in a musical family, what the first instrument might have been, or how you were drawn in through works or composers or a particular instrument to the arts that you now create and make your life with.
Oh, well, that's an open question that I could speak very long at length about, but I did grow up in a musical family. My father is a musicologist and a specialist in Renaissance a cappella music for voice. My mother is an early childhood music specialist and timpanist. My stepfather, also a musician, stepmother, also a musician. So I did grow up in a musical family. I started performing at a young age. I grew up in New York City. And I think my first claim to fame was that I worked with Julie Taymor as a nine-year-old, the production before The Lion King. And that was real career highlight and artistic highlight. It was just extraordinary to work with her. And I played concertmaster in my youth orchestra and went to Oberlin for double bass in composition and got my first master's degree in composition and my second in orchestral conducting. So you can kind of see the trajectory of my career through there. I was also a professional vocalist, singer, and play the piano. So if you saw me today, you'd think I was mostly work with the piano and orchestras, but I have a history with many other instruments.
The bio says that you've long been a champion as well of contemporary music. I wonder if that is a primary focus, or are there composers out of the tradition and the history of classical music that still hold a special spot for you when it comes to planning concerts or organizing recording projects and the like? Who are some of your greatest inspirations as composers?
Sure. Yeah, I have conducted a number of premieres, and I love working with living composers. And in part, that's because as a composer myself, I know just how important it is to have a successful premiere and to be performed, to have that experience of having your music in the world and be performed at the top level. There's no substitute for a great performance to know then the value and the true worth of a piece. It's very hard for people to distinguish, frankly, between the quality of a piece of music and the quality of a performance. That said, I became a conductor because of the music of Johannes Brahms, and it really became a professional musician because I fell so deeply in love with his symphonies. Of course, Bach was that there was a summer that I decided to become a composer and a professional musician, and I was playing a lot of Bach and Beethoven. And so I would say, you know, that's not very unusual to cite those three, but they really were my first deep loves and continue to inform my musical life. That said, I through performing so many contemporary composers, the wonderful experience of challenging oneself to meet the technical demands and to match the broad imagination of these wonderful musicians, it expands one's world and is so gratifying. And so I find that my musical taste and my appetite continues to expand almost exponentially as my career moves forward. And I just, I'm fascinated by more and more. And that's one of the things that music offers, is a never ending, it's like an expanding universe. The more you explore, the more you find.
The explorations and the findings of conductor James Blatchley. We're talking about that and more here today on Mosaic. Do you think, James, that they are so foundational when you mention a Bach or a Brahms, that in the music that you compose or the contemporary composers you have worked with and whose works you have premiered as a conductor and performer, do you find that they or the other past masters that there's almost no way to escape that influence? And is there one that you would say is even preeminent above the others in terms of influencing composers like yourself and the others you've worked with down through history? Which of those or some others that would be really at the very root of all that we continue to do and expand upon?
Well, that's a great question. The influence of other composers on one's own work is such a fascinating topic, because it can be both so inspiring and it can also be the opposite. I've heard it said that songwriting is like going fishing, composition by extension, and you just have to make sure you don't stand downstream from Bob Dylan, because he's going to catch all the fish. The same idea, I think, would apply to Bach. And so when I was composing primarily, I was full-time composing for a decade or more. And the one time I really found myself unable to write was when I was writing for solo violin, and I had been studying the sonatas and partitas of Bach. And I just found myself completely unable to put pen to paper, because what do you do after experiencing that music for solo violin? How do you find yourself in a position to offer anything to the world, after what Bach was able to do for violin? But actually, kind of bringing it back to this project of the prison, Dame Ethel Smythe was unfazed by studying Bach. And there's a wonderful part of the piece in the middle. It's choral music from the chapel, and it's the opening of part two, chorale prelude. And it's a series of, she composed five pieces in the style of Bach for solo organ. And it was early on in her career when she had first moved to Leipzig, Germany. And so there, in where Bach spent so many years of his career, the third main phase of his output was in Leipzig, and there she was, and encountering Bach for the first time. And she said she wanted to write music that countered Bach on his own terms, and so she wrote these pieces for organ. She had such courage, and some of us kind of shy away from trying to match Bach, and she. It just inspired her. It just made her want to create music in that style. And so I know we're kind of jumping topics, but I just think she has more courage and chutzpah than kind of anybody else I've encountered in my life.
But perhaps not a name that is as familiar to audiences as even other composers of the time and into the 20th century, Dame Ethel Smythe. And you speak of this new project that is to be released through Chandos Records with you on the podium for the premiere recording of a 1930 work. So here we are 90 years later, and the first recording here in 2020 of The Prison by Dame Ethel Smythe. And like some of these great masters we've been talking about, and even the references to the contemporary composers, you read through her work, and as I was reading up on her, she didn't write just for one instrument or one setting. Her works were varied across many different compositional styles, and she lived quite a colorful life, involved in the suffragette movement and much more in England. But there stands what is regarded as her masterwork, The Prison, this symphony in two parts, Close to Freedom and The Deliverance. When did you first encounter this work, and in becoming more immersed in it, when was the move made Was it a total self-driven, or were there others approaching you through your ensemble, the Experiential Orchestra, to say, now is the time that we bring this work from the stage to the recording, Ethel Smythe's The Prison?
Yeah, my experience with Smythe herself and her music really started in 2015 when Leon Botstein brought the Wreckers to Bard Festival in 2015. It was quite fascinating to encounter her and that piece, and many of us in the States had not heard of her. And I'm sure many of her listeners are in a position now where they have not heard of her music yet. I can say, after 5 years of working on this project, of performing this piece in particular and other pieces of hers, that one out of 100 perhaps will already know Smythe's music. So it's really nothing to be ashamed of if you haven't heard of her before. But in any case, my experience with the piece itself started in 2016 when two colleagues of mine, Unli and John McLaughlin Williams, were programming a concert that was all female composers, 2016, in July in New York City. And we started looking at Smythe, and a colleague of mine, Mark Shapiro, had put on the piano premiere of The Prison earlier that year in New York City with Cantori New York. And so the piece was kind of in the ether. It had been, you know, brought off the dusty shelf at that point in the piano version, which is also a really nicely done addition, created addition by Smythe herself after the orchestral version. So very good piano reduction. In any case, it had been performed, I believe, only once after Smythe's lifetime. She died in 1944. The last performance I know about is 1934, Royal Albert Hall in London. And not until 2008 was The Prison given again, and that was in Germany. And so in 2016, I knew that it had been performed. I didn't hear that performance, but some of the singers from that first piano performance joined us for what we gave as a reading with excerpts of the orchestral version in the summer of 2016. To create even those, to create the parts for that performance was a challenge in itself. You know, we performed 15 minutes of the piece, but all that we had were these manuscript parts and manuscript score. And I don't know if your listeners are aware of this, but we just don't perform from handwritten manuscripts anymore. Musicians are not accustomed to reading handwriting. We do everything with, you know, computer engravings. And they're very easy to read. There's no ambiguity about whether this is a B or a C sharp. But handwritten parts are, even from the neatest copyist, still at times challenging. So I undertook for us to create these engraved parts, and through that came to really get to know Smythe's handwriting in a really intimate and wonderful way, to look over every notation and explore it, and then fell in love with the piece at that first rehearsal. I mean, I loved it because I love everything I conduct, but I was really moved by the first rehearsal. The first sonority is this open C natural, very rich color in the orchestra, and I realized in a second that this sound had never been heard, this particular sound of this piece with full orchestra had never been heard in the United States ever until that rehearsal. And it felt like there was this genie that got let out of the bottle and was just soaring through the room, the spirit of this piece just saying, play me, let the world hear this piece. And it really did feel like a calling that I at times resisted, at times felt was too heavy a lift to create these parts, to speak to people about her and her music and say, no, it really is worth our attention, it really is worth doing. And somebody very early on in the publishing house, I won't say who it was, but, said, you don't want to perform that piece, it's not very good. and you should look elsewhere. And so there's this kind of general sentiment that it wasn't worth the time to put on. And it's massive forces, you know, full orchestra, soloist, chorus. It really does take a lot to put it together. But I kept hearing the music in my head. And so I undertook to create a new edition of the piece, which is now published and available through Wise Music Classical, and gave the U.S. premiere with orchestra. And then my colleague Mark Shapiro had ended up with going to give the piece as well shortly after. So he used the same edition. We actually collaborated on what we called a co-premiere, where we amplified each other's performances. And he gave it in Carnegie Hall, and mine was in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, with the Johnstown Symphony. And then I continued to kind of stay in love with the piece. And I said, you know, it's one thing to give the U.S. premiere and the co-premiere, and that's all well and good, but it actually deserves a world-class recording. It deserves for the world to hear it, you know, in as ideal a form as possible on a premier label. And so I gathered over the course of some years the funding to put on this recording in really ideal circumstances, with, you know, a great hall, amazing engineers, a great production team, fantastic orchestra, wonderful soloists, amazing chorus. I mean, just everything really lined up. And here we are. It's a recording that exists, and everybody can hear this piece finally.
Bringing us to this point, James Blatchley, as we talk about the first premiere recording, 90 years after it was completed, of Dame Ethel Smyth's The Prison, and to hear you speak on such a profound emotional level about the impact that the music had on you, we add to that notes written here saying that it is drawn from a philosophical work by Henry Bennett Brewster, a man in a solitary cell, his reflections on his life, his preparations for death, and also looking to the fact that the prison is both, quote, an actual jail and a philosophical representation of the shackles of self. And it just, to talk about a work that was so important to the composer, has had such a profound effect on you, and that all these things come together. We mentioned Smyth's involvement in the suffragette movement. This is the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. And yet, overlaying all of that, these extraordinarily impactful times of COVID-19, and to have a work like The Prison and all that it represents and all that it represented from Brewster's perspective to the music that it inspired from Dame Ethel Smyth, and now your discovery of it, what does it mean to you to have it coming together at not just any time, but this particular time?
Yeah, I obviously, we didn't know what was going to happen. We recorded this piece last year in February of 2019, and just it takes a while to produce a CD. And we wanted to line this up with the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment's ratification. So that's August of this year, and that's when the CD will be released. But I think our appreciation of the depths of meaning of this piece are uniquely suited to our time for two reasons. I mean, it's a universal piece. It's an eternal piece. It's a piece that will speak to people at really through history. But for two reasons right now, it has really a deeper resonance. One is that our world is more able to understand the complexities of her identity and accept her for who she was. She had to fight for just the ability to be herself at the time, a female composer, gender queer, it might be said. I don't know which term is best suited to match her identity, but certainly not straightforward binary. And we're learning so much as a society about the complexities of gender identity. So there's that, and then sexuality. So she has so much richness and complexity just built into who she was. But hopefully, and this is really my dearest hope, is that now that we are kind of understanding that these things are more complex, we can also let her music speak on its own terms and not in terms of her gender, as she was always identified as, you know, one critic said, pretty a remarkable achievement for a woman. And rather than, you know, say she's a good woman composer or a good female composer, say she's a masterful composer, you know, period, full stop. So that's one thing. It's this kind of identity, being able to understand her identity and accept and embrace all that she was and is. But the other is, as you said, this is an unprecedented time for all of us alive today of confronting uncertainty, and a time of solitude, a time of great loneliness for a lot of people, as we suffer in our own selves. I mean, it, physically, certainly, being, you know, shut in. And I think in particular about people in retirement communities, just how difficult this time is to be alone, and not have the loving touch of family and friends. And so in that case, in that sense, the prisoner is all too real a role for many of us, a reality, someone who is alone, looking over his life and wondering, what is this all about? Is this worth it? What has my life been for? And then in Smythe's setting, the soul responds and says, no man lives in vain, and comforts the prisoner in this exquisite way. And so I think the piece is at its heart a comforting piece. It reassures us, and it gives us a sense of inner peace. And so, yes, the shackles of self, which can torment us, the voices that are not particularly kind, that I would say all of us have in varying measures, that, you know, tell us we're not good enough, that we haven't done enough, that harp on our mistakes. And instead, this philosophy of Brewster's that Smythe presents in such a compelling way through this piece and through this music says, you are enough. We all deserve the joy that life offers. And in fact, the philosophy I've been reading again, kind of from cover to cover, just to kind of re-acclimate myself with the depths of the philosophy. It's really a fascinating work, Brewster's philosophical work that Smythe republished herself and then sets excerpts of for this symphony. The philosophy itself is really focused on finding moments of eternity, which we experience primarily in rapturous experiences of aesthetic beauty and art. And so in some ways, this piece is reminding us that music can give us a sense of peace and joy and make it all worthwhile.
And while you, James Blatchley, have worked so hard over the last 5 years to become familiar and become a champion of Smythe's music and to bring this project to light, and while it has been performed prior to this time of COVID-19, now, during this time that we are in, the recording is now available, the CD released through Chandos Records, with you on the podium with the Experiential Orchestra and the chorus and soloists. And we will celebrate that, to be sure. But it is our sincere hope that with all you have spoken so well to, that those that have listened today, and as we will eventually post this to our website and others will have a chance to listen to it, that when we all have the chance to get back to a concert hall, and even perhaps before that, to pick up the writings of Henry Bennett Brewster and read more about Dame Ethel Smythe, that the whole context and the whole depth and range of the work and all that it represents from the time that it was written to these present times, when this first recording 90 years later is made available, that again will be shared very soon with an audience. We hope that you stay safe and stay well, and we thank you so very much for being gracious with your time and speaking with us today.
Well, it's my real pleasure to speak with you, and I also hope that everyone listening today will fall madly in love with Dame Ethel Smythe's wonderful music. It's worth the exploration.